This is the summary of Uncharted by bestbookbriefings.com. Uncharted: How to Map the Future Together. Author: Margaret Heffernan. Part 1. Addiction Prediction. 1. False Prophets. In 1898, the economist Irving Fisher was diagnosed with tuberculosis. At the time, the disease was the greatest cause of death in the West. With no known cure or accurate prognosis, contracting tuberculosis meant a lifetime of uncertainty. Would your life end in a few weeks, a few years? The uncertainty hurt as much as the disease itself. People coped in their own ways, looking for causes or cures. Looking at events at the start of the 20th century, it's clear that Fisher wasn't the only one grappling with uncertainty. Markets were crashing, revolutions were rising up as new countries formed. Radical scientific and cultural changes were cropping up everywhere, from plastics to radio to cinema. Beneath it all was an undercurrent of barely contained anxiety and mayhem. From this, a new market emerged, one that was anxious to know what the future held in store. Financial panics in the US exposed how little consumers and investors really knew about the state of their companies. Three men rose to fill that need: Irving Fisher, Roger Babson, and Warren Persons. All three believed they could use data to discover future market trends and were eager to sell their advice. All three had been diagnosed with tuberculosis, and so they knew the pain of uncertainty. Irving Fisher analyzed the nation's economy through the lens of its money supply. His theory was that too much money would cause a boom, and too little would cause a bust. The government wasn't measuring the supply, so he started tracking it himself, collecting mountains of data indexes. His indexes revealed volatility in prices and markets, so he became obsessed with the notion of a stable economy. What brought stability, and how could it be sustained? The more data he collected, the more questions emerged. Fisher became one of the world's first economic pundits, respected for his mathematical rigor. Roger Babson believed that Newton's third law of motion applied to economics as well: for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. For every period of economic depression, there was a period of economic prosperity. The faster the market fell, the faster it would recover. He believed that every piece of data was predicting something, and that he was the man to decode it all. By 1910, Babson also became a national financial pundit. Warren Persons was an accomplished statistician. He was skeptical that any theory could fully capture the complexity of the economic market. The best you could do was measure what was in front of you and determine if any patterns in the data you saw matched data from the past. In essence, his forecasts were based on the belief that history repeated itself. All three men were personally invested in their theories and staunchly criticized each other's methods. Each man believed that they alone held the key to the future. In October 1929, this belief was put to the test. Fisher claimed that the stocks had reached a permanent plateau of prosperity, finally reaching stability. When the market crashed on October 24, he refused to concede, insisting that recovery was just around the corner. As a result, he held onto his shares and lost his fortune. Persons was just as unprepared for the crash. For months afterwards, he insisted that since there was no historical precedent for it, a normal recovery was sure to follow. Unable to let go of his idea that the economy moved in cycles like the tides, his service shut down in 1931. Despite being the least scientific of the three, Babson came out of the crash for the better. He'd been predicting a crash every year for the past 3 years, stating that fair weather cannot always continue. He basked in his glory, but in May 1931 he announced that the market had already bottomed out and it was time to start investing again. It would be more than a decade before the US economy would actually begin to recover. Although all three imagined themselves as scientists uncovering objective and absolute laws about the market, the fact of the matter is that they had more faith than skill. Faced with uncertainty, they believed that finding patterns in their data would give them control over their lives. They injected the certainty that they and their readers craved into their theories, into their data. The legacy these men left behind is the commercialization of a fantasy that the future is knowable, that life is subject to certain laws, and that there are special people and processes that can determine them. Babson, Fisher, and Persons proved that there was money and fame to be found in the forecasting business. They also discovered that forecasts are plagued with two problems. The first problem is that predictive models are subjective and incomplete representations of our complex reality. Fisher and Babson didn't have the means to collect or comprehend all the existing economic data, so they had to choose what to include and what not to. This is an editing process all economists do, even with our advanced technology today. The second problem is a problem of agenda. As Alan Greenspan once testified, every person carries an ideology, a conceptual framework with which they deal with reality, a set of beliefs about how the world works and what matters. This ideology carries over and affects any mental model and decision a person makes. The third problem is a matter of drama. The prediction business holds a commercial interest in making forecasting look more precise than it actually is. Where there's more precision, there's more drama. Where there's more drama, there's more money. As forecasters gain bigger reputations, they can make more money by being bold. They can exploit our hopes and fears for their own gain, manipulating our discomfort with uncertainty. Fisher lived until he was 80. Parsons lived to 90. Persons died at 59. No one will ever know if their personal regimens extended their lives, or even if their diagnoses were accurate in the first place. All we know is that they thought they were, and that belief was a powerful motivator. 2. Does history repeat itself? As much as we might like to live in the moment, we are all mental time travelers. In 2007, the Department of Cognitive Neuroscience at University College London reported that one of the functions of memory is that it allows us to simulate the future. We draw from our past experiences in order to imagine what lies ahead. In planning a route to a new address, taxi drivers will use their memories of landmarks and routes and combine it with their current knowledge of traffic conditions. Old information combines with the present for a vision of a future destination. However, making memories requires us to pay attention to where we are and what we're doing. Drivers who utilized GPS often had a less developed sense of direction than the ones who spent time observing their surroundings. The less we engage with the present, the weaker our mental scenarios of the future become. Our memories are unreliable. We carry multiple versions of our memories and draw on them depending on the situation. The prospect of going to the dentist might seem grim if you're feeling fine, but if you're dealing with a toothache, it may inspire relief. We pay more attention to the way events finish than how they start, and larger events are remembered more easily than trivial ones. The fluidity of our memory isn't necessarily a bad thing, as it lets us be more adaptable and creative thinkers. It's also important to remember that our brains aren't computers. When we remember something, we don't just replay it like a video, we recreate it on the spot, adding, subtracting, or rearranging it into a new memory as we go. While this process might seem like a flaw, it's actually a strength. There's no limit to what we can create with our minds. We are not trapped by our past, nor do we leave it behind. Our lives are not narratives that follow an invisible script. Yesterday's route won't always be today's. Humans, like history, are fluid, not static. We experience ourselves in a variety of ways over time, and we learn and grow from our experiences. A bad start need not be a bad ending, and a choice made early on does not have to determine the rest of a person's life. Does history repeat itself? George Santayana is famous for the quote, "Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it." However, he was writing specifically about a person's development from childhood to old age. Learning is dependent on remembering progress. Karl Popper argues that since human progress depends on the growth of human knowledge, we can't know what we don't know yet, or how quickly we'll learn. If history repeats itself, historians at this point would be able to identify patterns and principles that we could use to predict and act on the future. Yet no such thing exists. The purpose of history is to challenge assumptions that we have made about ourselves, not confirm them. People like to depend on historical parallels because it amps up the drama, and the idea that history is an inevitable force of nature favors the powerful, while keeping everyone else in the margins. Such a narrative implies that the power to change, to improve, belongs only to the privileged few. 3. Well-ordered sheep. Parents worry about their children. What opportunities can they have? What kinds of people will they connect with? What kind of career will they have in the future? Worry makes parents more attentive, but it can become destructive when it encourages them to find an instant solution, which is exactly the huge and lucrative market for parenting products provides. Soko's Learning has developed an app called Muse, which claims to use deep cognitive modeling and machine learning in order to predict a child's life outcomes and recommends the appropriate parenting approach. Muse's standards are based on its studies of great historical figures, but this is a logical fudge. When you look at very successful people, the tendency is to notice their positive qualities and ignore their failures. It's also impossible to truly determine if their success was due solely to their individual traits, when it could also be the era that they lived in, the people who helped them, or just plain dumb luck. How do you define success? If it's by money, power, or longevity, then Mussolini wins over Mozart. Apps aren't neutral entities in their impact or their agenda. All technology outsources work from humans to machines with the promise of efficiency. But there is a paradox at play here: the less we do something, the worse we get at it. The impact here is felt all the more with parents, who lose out on the valuable lessons learned through family life. What's the point of having kids if they're raised by something else? The failure here isn't in the exploitation of parents, it's in treating a child as an object to be trained and programmed, following the myth that a person is nothing more than a collection of data, and with enough data, one can predict the future. Astrology promises this, and so do personality tests. Personality profiles like the Myers-Briggs Type Indicator can be conversation starters, or a way to build a sense of community. However, we have to consider that people tend to believe what they are told about themselves. Tell a child that they're bad at math, or lazy and slow, and they'll quickly change to meet those expectations. Tell an adult that they're punctual, and they'll start showing up on time. Profiling and assessment tools are a cheap and fast way to process resumes. But they can also encourage stereotypes, reducing people into types and commodities. If forecasts fail individuals, then it's reasonable to hope they'll be more successful when it comes to analyzing large systems and trends. If we could better understand the complexities of humankind, then we could determine which people and endeavors to invest in, thus wasting less time and resources. But it's not that simple. Take the field of science, for example. Governments and businesses spend billions on research, with hundreds of fields and tens of thousands of researchers. Could this complex system be engineered to create more results, faster and better? Certain scientific breakthroughs come as a natural conclusion. Knowledge, technology, and ingenuity line up at the right time to produce something groundbreaking. Others, like penicillin, are complete flukes, which no one could have planned for. Still, other breakthroughs are sleeping beauties, which need other big discoveries before their full potential is unlocked. There is no formula for the breakthrough genius scientist. Some discoveries come from seasoned, accomplished scientists, others from the overlooked or the new players. However, we might want to make the scientific process more efficient. The truth is that simplifying a complex system like this doesn't always ensure that they become more effective. In fact, it's the opposite. Science functions best when it's robust, with a wide variety of insights and perspectives. It can look wasteful from the outside, but when you don't know what's needed, you're safer with more. Eliza Manningham Buller served as the Director General at MI5 for 5 years. In her time, she learned that the ability to take action is more important than having perfect knowledge. Whatever you do, you will need to make a decision based on incomplete knowledge. Consequences can be lethal, but so is inaction. Manningham Buller required that her people not just tell her what she wanted to hear, but to have the insight and courage to argue with her and present alternative perspectives so that they could assess the situation from as many angles as possible. This process took time, but when facing ambiguous threats, being able to remain open-minded to even stray bits of data, instead of giving in to the temptation of an easy, certain conclusion, was important. So where does this leave us? Can we live with the fact that nothing can really untangle the complexity of our lives? Every generation of humanity has lived with uncertainty. It's how we develop the capacity for discovery, for creativity. Necessity is the mother of invention, not comfort. Faced with uncharted waters, who would be content to hug the shore? Part 2: What would you do if you were free? 4: No available datasets. Experiments are how we learn. In learning to walk, we stand, fall over, and try again, improving each time. The key to experiments is that they are a creative response to uncertainty. After all, if we knew what was going to happen, then we wouldn't need to test anything. Because so many of the systems we live in are complex, the experiments we conduct within them require bringing together people from all sorts of backgrounds and perspectives. They demand collaboration. It's hard work, but it's worth it, because it's one of the ways small organizations can make a big difference, whether it's in tackling economic inequality or climate change. Learning to start with what you have and where you are is valuable. Waiting for the perfect master plan is tricky, as it may be too complex or wrong or just too late. Traditional management struggles with this, especially in the face of larger threats. As much as executives claim to support innovation, they really want safety and certainty, not creativity and risk. The irony is that the more they demand security, the harder the path to a safe future becomes. Closures and layoffs are planned meticulously in lieu of risking invention to keep businesses alive. Strategic planning has worked for so many companies for decades, but has the turn of the tide left them paralyzed, unable to explore without a map? When trying to change the future, it can be tempting to wish for a blank slate. Software developers always reach a point in bug fixing where they throw up their hands and wonder if it would just be better to start again. The belief here is that the next time around, they'll get it perfectly. This is never the case, as the new version will just have different problems. Perfection is a myth. In a similar vein, many have been tempted to look at their democratic institutions and conclude that they are impossible to reform. Time to throw it all out. The realization of a crisis isn't wrong, but a crisis isn't the time to give up on experimenting. It's the time to start. If we want to map the future, we need to acknowledge that while everyone can contribute, no one really knows what we'll find. When collaborating with others, use simple language, forgo the structures of power and agenda. Don't entrust your future to someone who might not even know more than you do. Be bold, and use every kind of imagination at your disposal to open up more options ahead. 5. Go fast, go far. Shell first implemented their now famous scenario planning system in the 1970s. At the time, all the oil companies assumed their business would continue into the future with no significant changes. However, Shell's team created a number of scenarios that imagined a different world. Challenging the conventional wisdom that oil prices would always rise, one scenario asked Shell what their response would be if they fell. At the time, this seemed absurd, but in 1973, they did. All the other companies scrambled to respond, but Shell was ready to move. This enabled them to go from being the weakest oil company to becoming one of the strongest in the world. Shell's scenario planning followed a set of rules. Every scenario needed to be based on the same carefully researched datasets. The data couldn't be ideological or vague and opinionated. Each scenario must be considered as seriously as any other. Scenarios are less about predicting the outcome and more about understanding the forces that influence the outcome. Shell doesn't claim that this technique lets them see the future. Rather, it provides them with options and alternatives. Thinking imaginatively can be harder than you expect. We are all born with the ability to do so, but how boldly we can imagine can depend on our habits or the environment we develop in. You can be too afraid of being wrong that you lose the ability to think freely. Fear of change can make a miserable present more bearable than a hopeful future. 6. Living the questions. Works of art made centuries ago can be so ahead of their time that they can still be relevant today. How is that possible? We don't see artists worry about future-proofing their work that's out of their hands. Artists learn to live productively with complexity and ambiguity. They mine it for material, forging works that they can't see until they are finished. Although we may not all be artists, there's much to learn from their habits. Notice. Noticing for artists is a habit of the mind. Many artists are sensitive to seemingly small and unimportant details in people and in the world. An integral part of the creative process is in not creating, just taking time to go about the world, absorbing raw ingredients for later. The wandering mind does not have a plan, but is drawn to the unfamiliar, the ambiguous. Sometimes observations may go unused for years, until one day the right train of thought or question is triggered. Simmer. from all of their accumulated observations, which ones will be used. Artists must decide. The process between collecting and making can be described by many words, but can be hard to explain all the same. Artists simply trust that meaning will emerge as they go. Waiting for things to make sense can take courage, stamina, and optimism. This period defies planning and forecasting and can feel like a waste of time and productivity. But the ability to tolerate this uncertainty equips artists to better function in an unpredictable world. To be an artist requires finding a reason to keep moving. State. Artists start without being asked to. Choosing a subject means having to abandon the rest, with no real assurance that it's the right choice. The only way to find out is to start. The start doesn't determine the ending. The work will still evolve over time, but it also means that there is an element of worry that is present at all times. Every artist has to carry the fear that their work will fail. But that anxiety is a motor to get it done. The lack of certainty is uncomfortable, but not paralyzing. The more an artist explores the work, the more they may find within it. So they need to stay alert to the unexpected, as it's what keeps the work alive and lets it continue to live past its completion. Fail. With the appreciation of complexity and uncertainty comes the knowledge that artists can't control how their work is received. Recognizing that so much art fails can be painful, but accepting that fact also gives them freedom. It can be disappointing if a work flops, but at least it can teach them how to do things better the next time. The future can't be nailed down or programmed. The only way to influence it is to keep observing and to keep trying. The ability to pay attention, make sense of things, act, and change ahead of the curve are highly valued in many organizations today. When Warren Buffett and Ian Golden call themselves artists, the implication is that conventional rules alone can't give you the alertness and flexibility needed to adapt. When it comes to charting the future, encouraging the search is more important than determining the outcome. This is easier said than done, as few leaders are prepared to give their employees the freedoms of an artist. Allowing people to think like an artist requires more than colorful walls and toys. It requires quiet spaces for thinking and free time away from the office. After all, to have insights that are relevant to life requires having a life. One that's rich in experience and benefits from time to reflect. On a personal level, we need to exercise our capacity for creativity, discovery, and invention, or we'll lose it. Depending on technology takes away the strain, but robs us of the benefits. Taking photographs results in a poorer visual memory. Online research gives us information that's quick, but also doesn't stick around for long. The more we multitask, the harder it becomes for us to pay attention to a single thing. Artists think for themselves, and in the process, they claim the right to influence the future of their lives, their work, and their audience. Part 3: Life happens. 7. Simple, not easy. Life comes at you fast. However prepared we are to make the future, sometimes it arrives before we expect it, creating a make-or-break scenario. These moments are unpredictable, but how can we survive them? There are lessons to be learned from how we have dealt with crises in the past. Progress can be lumpy, moving forward, back, or stalling entirely. Problems don't arrive in a neat, conclusive package, but solutions will emerge eventually. Efficiency can be lethal allies, and an extravagance of creative thinking will rise to meet the challenge. Crises are personal. Companies are saved by people who care about each other, and adults change their minds when the arguments start coming from their children. There is a temptation to sentimentalize a crisis by finding nostalgia in the solidarity and meaning people found through surviving. But going into a crisis with years of trust already built is what gives people their resilience. Staying human, not just a consumer, is the first step to preparing for an unpredictable future. Expect to be surprised. By nature, complex systems will bring about weird, unforeseen events. You may come into a crisis expecting to accomplish one thing, and instead see your actions to lead to new horizons, both good and bad. As David France once said, faith defies uncertainty. 8. Who wants to live forever? Death comes for us all. Anthropologists and psychologists have argued for centuries that the prospect of dying is so terrifying that we invented religions or complex systems of denial in order to go on living. However, reading the writings of the terminally ill, or those in death row, show that the inevitable end can actually bring a time of deep achievement and satisfaction. Death is often seen as a failure. Doctors are trained to improve and save lives, but spend only a few hours in their training with the dying. Death isn't an error or a bug, it's a natural process that can occur with honor and dignity. When Rajthamathiram received a cancer diagnosis, he rejected the metaphor of cancer as a war. He knew he was a fighter, but he also knew that the progression of the disease wasn't a moral judgment on him. Bad enough that he had to fight the disease, having to prove himself by defeating it would have belittled him. The transhumanist movement imagines a near future in which technology will make immortality a matter of fact. They take it as a given that more life means a better life, and that the lives of the elders are only worth complaining about. There's money to be made in combating the aging process, from supplements to surgery, to the holy tech grail of cryogenic storage, which promises to freeze a person until sufficiently advanced technology is developed to cure their ills and extend their lifespans indefinitely. You could see this as a modern rewrite of the ancient myths around death and rebirth. Where we once believed in gods, we now believe in technology. But we would do better to think of mortality as a gift, not a curse. There's much to be taught in achieving a good death. Being willing to think about and discuss such things opens us up to thinking differently about life, and sets a good example for those who come after us. One must decide how to go about it. Do you fight, seeking out any available treatment in order to get more time? Do you focus on appreciating the friendships and experiences you have developed during your stay here? Take chances you never did before, explore new horizons? The choice is yours to make, and is an integral part of your life story. Death is a transition. The people you love and lose remain with you forever, shaping who you are and how you think. They are traces of a future your children will inherit. You may never be certain of where people go after death, but the best you can do is to set them free. 9. Be prepared. In an uncertain age, being prepared can make us crave predictive models. When old models fail us, we immediately start looking for new ones to comfort us. But the world is too diverse for a single big, binary idea to fit it. To be prepared, one needs to be resilient. One needs to pay attention to the multiple, interconnected systems that we exist in, to the way we influence them, and they influence us. Making the future is a collaboration. No one person can see enough of the future. For decisions to be credible and good for everyone, they must be developed by more than a few experts or authorities. Our institutions need to be prepared to reform in order to maintain trust and stay relevant. This requires being mindful of the society they serve. As such, this approach requires new kinds of leaders chosen for their skepticism, not their confidence. They need to be able to collect perspectives and reconcile opposing viewpoints in order to adapt. An effective leader's greatest asset isn't power, but the ability to make people feel that a better future is possible, practical, and meaningful. They need to be honest when sacrifices are needed, and they need to resist the temptation of oversimplified fantasies that only serve to provide comfort. How can we map the future? We need to hold on to the gifts that we have: imagination, creativity, variety, faith, and courage. We need to develop them together. What we need to be is human. It doesn't matter where we start. All that matters is that we do. Whether you prefer to read or listen, we have something for you. Visit bestbookbriefings.com for more summaries.